Speaker is Dr. Damin Phan from GeoSyntech. Damin Phan is an environmental engineer with GeoSyntech Consultants. Previously, he was an ORISE research fellow with the US EPA, where he conducted evaluation of various innovative in-situ groundwater remediation technologies for the Superfund program. One of his main research focuses at EPA was in-situ activated carbon-based technologies. He has also made significant contributions to developing and improving iron-based technologies for chlorinated solvent remediation. Dr. Phan obtained a BS in environmental science from Nanjing University, China, an MS in soil physics from the University of Delaware, and a PhD in environmental science and engineering from Oregon Health and Science University. Dr. Phan, are you ready to begin?
Yes, I am.
Okay, excellent. At this point, I will hand it over to you.
All right, thank you, Cindy and Jane, for the introduction. Today, my presentation will be focused on an overview of activated carbon-based technology for in-situ subsurface remediation. As Cindy mentioned, this topic is the main project I worked on as an ORISE research fellow with the EPA Superfund office, which ended about 2 months ago when I joined the GeoSyntech. So before I start, I'd like to get some input from the audience on the line by doing some polls. There should be two polls appearing on the left corner of the screen. So I saw some people already selected. If you haven't done so, please do. The first poll is about your current professional affiliation, and the second poll is about two most frequent sources likely to reference when you're evaluating any emerging remedial technology, let's say for feasibility study. Just give some folks some time to click through the answers. Okay, looks like we have people joining from every sector of the remediation industry. So two biggest groups here are the consultants and the regulators, and they also have some product vendors and the responsible parties, as well as the academic researchers and remediation contractors. So coming from different backgrounds, you are all expected to have different interests when you encounter any new remedial technologies. Vendors might be more interested in promoting and marketing their products. Regulators might be more concerned about whether technology can produce results that comply with existing regulations and policies. So if you're responsible parties or work for responsible parties as a consultant or remediation contractors, you're mostly interested in whether technology can serve as a to save the long-term cost and reduce future environmental liability. So for this technology, this different perspective for a long time have not reconciled very well. This is largely because we're lacking academic participation as independent evaluation. So we're missing an important player here as a researcher. Mostly because activated carbon has been extensively researched and used in engineered water treatment system that also creates some preoccupied perception or misperception about using this technology for in-situ groundwater remediation. For example, we all know that activated carbon media needs periodical replacement above ground treatment. Obviously, there's no way to do that in-situ. That creates a perception that in-situ applications eventually will create a contaminant-saturated activated carbon in the subsurface. So 3 years ago, when my branch at EPA started looking at this technology, we're taking a skeptical but leading forward approach. So I'm directly quoting one of my former colleagues here. So we don't want the pretender, but we also don't want to kill the real contender. So we collected a lot of information from different sources, including research in relevant areas and challenges of technology vendors to address those major questions people asked. Today in this webinar, we're trying to share a summary of the latest information we knew about this technology in terms of science, engineering, and field applications. I'll start by giving an overview on these elements. The following two speakers will go into more details on two essential aspects of technology, best practice for application and degradation processes in the field. So what is in-situ active carbon-based technology? In April 2018, EPA Superfund Office published a fact sheet on AC-based remedial technology. The link is given here. The definition that the technology applies a composite or mixture of AC and chemical or biological amendments that commonly are used in a range of in-situ treatment technologies, such as in-situ chemical oxidation, reduction, or bioremediation. The difference between composite and mixture is composite actually indicate there's a physical chemical association between activated carbon and amendments as opposed to the simple physical mixture. But nowadays, we have 6 commercial products and one research product, 2 composites and 5 mixtures, 5 for chlorinated solvents and 3 for petroleum hydrocarbons. You may realize 5 plus 3 is 8, actually more than 7. That's because one product, you can adjust amendment corresponding to the contaminant you are treating. One thing I want to emphasize here is the different products, different particle sizes ranging from granular to powder to colloidal. That will determine where and how this amendment can be applied in the subsurface. We'll come back to that later. So this table lists the currently available products, the year they're developed, their properties, the target contaminants, and the proposed degradation pathway. RPI owns 3 powder or granular materials on the market. BOS 100 and BOS 200 are the 2 earlier players in the market, treating chlorine solvents and petroleum hydrocarbon respectively. For more recent products, COGAC involve chemical oxidation. Plumestop is a colloidal activated carbon. It's active carbon-only product without adding any reactive amendments, but you can combine it with different types of amendments for either chlorine solvents or petroleum hydrocarbons. The carbon iron is the only product developed by the research community. You will hear more about this product from Dr. McKenzie's presentation in today's webinar. And EH Plus is the latest activated carbon-based product, involves combination of conventional EHC and powder activated carbon. So there are 2 fundamental processes involved in contaminant removal by activated carbon-based technology, absorption and degradation. So activated carbon has a large absorption capacity simply because of numerous micropores created by these irregular layer structures. For typical organic contaminants in the groundwater, absorption process is a reversible process. That indicates once condition changes such as pH or plume composition, the equilibrium between absorption and desorption will shift. Desorption can occur, so the contaminants absorbed in its micropores can eventually come out to the aqueous phase. On the degradation side, the mechanistic aspects for all degradation pathways have been relatively well characterized. It's worth noting that degradation is aqueous phase reaction. That means sorbent contaminant is not available for degradation before it's desorbed into the aqueous phase. The desorption can also regenerate absorption sites, although the efficiency of the regeneration remains unknown because the amendment or degradation process itself can change the property of activated carbon, therefore affecting the absorption processes. So water treatment literature has long recognized the synergy between activated carbon and degradation. For example, active carbon-supported biofilm has been shown to be effective for water treatment since the 1980s. More recently, Department of Defense funded a research showing active carbon-supported biofilm enhanced extent of PCB dechlorination in sediment. So in this figure on the bottom right corner, you can see the particle of active carbon covered by a fluorescent labeled PCB dechlorination bacteria. So for the abiotic reaction, this 2009 EPA study shows nano zero-valent iron that impregnated into active carbon has more persistent reactivity than NZVI itself. Despite the supporting materials, those studies are all conducted in a well-controlled system where contaminant medium contact is optimized and operational variables can be finely controlled. So one of the most frequently raised questions I heard regarding this technology is whether and how much these benefits can be replicated in the field. So in typical field applications, absorption can rapidly remove contaminant aqueous phase, resulting in this kind of concentration versus time profile. So a lot of earlier applications actually giving you data like this only, which makes people skeptical about whether degradation is occurring or not, especially at the later monitoring period. But in more recent applications, efforts have been made to confirm that degradation is occurring, either using alternative indicators or environmental molecular diagnostic tools. So just to give you a couple examples, this slide shows abiotic reductive chlorination with BOS 100 at a dry cleaner site in Fracture Rock, provided by AS Environmental, who is the contractor for RPI. Here, the left axis shows the production of chloride in milligram per liter, and the right axis shows the production of ethane and ethane in microgram per liter. So between 2012 and 2018, we can see a steady increase in concentration of species post-injection. Just to note it, this well is located just outside the source area, so the initial contaminant concentration is relatively high, so it is relatively easier to detect the changes in chloride, ethane, and ethane. So for plume with a low concentration, the difference might be too subtle to pick up. So this is another dry cleaner site where plume stop and bioremediation was coupled to treat a chlorinated solvent plume. The initial CVOC concentration here is much lower than the previous case. After injection, if you see the black curve, the concentration quickly dropped. Then the microbial data, all these color curves, showed elevated and sustained abundance of dechlorination bacteria and genes throughout 500 days post-injection, despite very little chlorinated solvent. That indicates this elevation must result from enhanced microbial population occurring upgrading of this monitoring well, presumably where the activated carbon-based barrier is located. So this slide is a preview of part of Dr. McKenzie's presentation. This pilot study is by far, from my opinion, the most comprehensive long-term characterization and documentation of degradation processes in the field, where AC-based technology was applied. So I won't spoil too much about Dr. McKenzie's presentation, but if you're looking for academic independent evaluation of the technology in the field, Dr. McKenzie's publication will probably be your best go-to sources currently, even though the product is not the same as the commercial product here in US, but they resemble enough similarities. So with that being said, we still have two major science questions that remains to be addressed. The first one is about the long-term infectiveness. But this applies to other reactant-based technologies as well. So the only difference here is for other technologies, we can easily evaluate that, but for AC-based technology, we might not know when degradation stops because absorption may hold the contaminants for much longer. So once we start accumulating more sites and more data, we'll get a better sense of long-term effectiveness. The second question regards the prospective contribution between absorption and degradation. This one has important policy implications. If absorption is a dominant removal mechanism, then we're leaving the waste in place, which has the potential to release due to desorption process. However, if one can show that by maintaining sufficient degradation activity is enough to counter the continuous but slow desorption processes, maybe leaving the waste in place may not be a big issue. So how do we address this pending question? I think the answer is to form a strong partnership among different stakeholders to pursue research questions. I've seen a lot of examples in Europe, but here in the US, it hasn't happened that much. We start seeing more and more examples over the last few years. For example, Regenesis and Colorado State partnered to study the effects of plume stop and bioremediation on mitigating back diffusion from low permeability zones. American Petroleum Institute also funded University of Waterloo to study biodegradation of BTECs involved in AC-based technology. NIEHS has a grant to Johns Hopkins University, USGS, and Geosyntec to study active carbon plus mixed biofilm for chlorobenzene degradation. So this study is actually very interesting because the preliminary data shows the composition of biofilm changes as a function of redox conditions in subsurface. As I mentioned earlier, CERDEP has a grant to University of Maryland to study active carbon-supported biofilm for PCB dechlorination. So perhaps the most relevant research is the project to be funded by Air Force in the summer. So last year, U.S. Air Force has a board agency announcement interested in investigating the and validating the application of couple absorption degradation technologies to address chlorinated solvent sites with complex hydrogeology. The proposal needs to provide a field-scale demonstration and the validation of amendment delivery, sorption sequestration, biogeochemistry, and contaminant degradation. So I think the next few years we're going to see a lot of papers and reports coming out, which will further enhance our understanding of this technology. Now, let's move on to the engineering aspect. Every technology has its own niche. When AC-based technology was developed, the niche was to rely on the combination of absorption and degradation as a long-term mechanism to combat back diffusion from low permeability zones, which is one of the major remediation challenges in many sites that have long history of contamination and a complex geology. So this one slide just summarizes some of the basic principles of application. This figure shows a simplified cross-section of subsurface where you have a residual contamination stored inside the low K zone. Two ways of applying activated carbon-based amendments For granular powder active carbon, because of the large particle size, the one needs to fracture the low permeability zones using high pressure to place those material in. And by fracturing this material in, it also cuts the diffusion path of contaminants from low K to high K zones. For colloidal activated carbon, particle size is much smaller, so they can be placed in the sandy aquifer under low pressure, but not in the clay in the silt. So it essentially forms the 104 PRBs, intercepted plume coming from the upgradient. The technology could also be applied as area treatment in the source area, which limits the mass flux feeding the downgradient plumes. And Dr. Winner's presentation will show you more details about the engineering aspect. So move on to application. In 2015, the Remediation Journal published a perspective featuring this technology. In the article, RPI reported that they have over 100 chlorinated solvent sites and over 1,000 petroleum sites by 2015. For newer products like plume stock, the number is also quite significant. As of 2017, over 50 sites with half and half between chlorinated solvents and petroleum hydrocarbons. Majority of those sites are private and state sites. For federal sites, the number is much smaller, but growing over the last few years. So far, the federal program has two record sites for national priority Superfund sites and for Department of Defense sites. The applications at Superfund sites is particularly encouraging because Superfund program tends to be very conservative and slow in applying new technologies. So in the next few slides, I'm going to solely focus on the application at federal sites. But as you may see from next presentation by Dr. Winner, a lot of best practice is actually developed in the private sites and now being applied at federal sites. So this three pie charts just give you an overview of the site conditions where this technology has been applied. Currently, VOCs obviously was a major group of contaminant concern, but we also have petroleum hydrocarbons and PAHs. Concentration-wise, we're talking about low to intermediate range. At private state sites, technology has been applied to treat at much higher concentrations, such as NAPO-like scenario, but that has not happened at federal sites. We also have a variety of geological settings, ranging from homogeneous structure geological formation to heterogeneous geological formation. So in terms of technology application, majority of the sites use the barrier type to treat plumes, and three used for area treatment of the source areas. Among the plume treatment, two sites were actually using active carbon only without adding any reactive amendments for some reasons. So one site is to prevent the production of vinyl chloride, and the other site is to prevent the remobilization of arsenic and manganese from the reducing condition developed by bioaugmentation. So for three sites that you couple for source air treatment, AC-based technologies all coupled with a more aggressive treatment technology such as solid vapor extraction or mobile dual-phase extraction. So the technology essentially serves as a secondary mechanism to further reduce mass flux discharge to the downgradient once a majority of the contaminant mass in the source has been removed. So the technology was selected as federal sites when prior technology could not achieve remediation goal, other technology determined to be not suitable. Here just give you a few examples. At a former Lowry Air Force Base, the initial technology was alkaline activated persulfate. It resulted 70% of carbon tetrachloride and concentration reduction in bedrock aquifer, but 6 months after, we had a rebound. At a former Intel facility, Superfund sites in Region 9, multiple attempts have been given to try to reduce the TCE concentration below MCL, but one monitoring well is resistant to all the treatments, including in-situ chemical oxidation, monitor natural attenuation, and pump and treat. At another Superfund site in Region 6, injection of emulsified vegetable oil for bioremediation impacted water quality, as I mentioned earlier, immobilizing the arsenic and manganese, and also requires ongoing maintenance due to the biofouling of the injection wells. Pump and treat option is limited at this site because of property access issues. The Vandenberg Air Force Base and the FCX Superfund site in North Carolina, production of vinyl chloride and high groundwater velocity adjacent to the surface water was a major concern that prevented the selection of bioremediation or in-situ chemical oxidation. So finally, I'll also show you some of the performance data. This figure presents the data from all sites that apply this technology or federal sites. So it is a little bit complicated. Let me walk you through that. So here we plot the parent contaminant concentration in the most recent monitoring well on the y-axis for the wells that are expected to be influenced by the injection. On the x-axis is the baseline concentration. So different colors represent different sites. The symbol size represents a monitoring period since the application at this site is all different. So here we're covering the 5 to 15 month monitoring period. You can ignore the numbers because numbers are just arbitrary numbers assigned to different sites. The green diagonal line is a 1-to-1 ratio line, and the horizontal line is a red horizontal red line is the MCL. So you can see majority of the data points fall below the green line, indicating concentration reduction. So many points were actually below the MCL. Two clusters of data points I want to emphasize here is this vertical rectangular box contains the data from two sites that applied active carbon only without adding any reactive amendments. And the three red diamonds inside the horizontal rectangular box are from a site that the technology has been applied in multiple areas with different concentration range. So all these sites will be continued to be monitored. So the information we collect later will provide us with more data about the long-term effectiveness of absorption-only process and how performance might vary or change with different plume strength. The benefits to Superfund program. So the first two points have already been considered in application. Obviously, technology can reduce the risk of plume offsite migration because of a rapid absorption process of contaminants. It can also reduce the long-term mass flux from the source zone when it coupled with other aggressive treatment technology. The third and fourth point hasn't been reflected in Superfund application, but conceivably the technology will provide some value to that. For example, the lingering and returning sites due to complex hydrogeology occupy a significantly portfolio of the Superfund sites. The possible longevity advantage of this technology to combat back diffusion will provide a lot of opportunities at those sites. And also, we're interested in studying more about the biofilm concept using for in situ remediation technology. And potentially, it can also accelerate the cleanup and save some long-term cost by replacing some existing pump and treat system that has been going on at Superfund sites for many, many years. So to conclude, AC-based remediation technology is still emerging technology for in-situ groundwater treatment. The science, engineering, and regulatory fronts are actively evolving. For science, we're starting seeing more active interest in this area. For example, so more interest has been focused on the electrical properties of carbonaceous material for contaminant degradation. That carbonaceous material also includes activated carbon. We need to spend more interest and resources on studying the interaction between activated carbon and microorganisms such as biofilm and the resulting effects on contaminant degradation, and also need to study more on the desorption kinetics and risk, which it hasn't been studied that much in the research. This potentially has a huge implication on evaluating the long-term effectiveness of this technology. In engineering, we still need to evaluate and optimize the long-term performance of this technology, largely based on the data we collected from the scientific research. On the regulatory side, the regulatory categorization of the technology will mainly be based on the science and engineering understanding of the technology. But at the same time, regulatory requirements may also be a driver for better use and evaluating technology in the field by mandating some of the monitoring frequency and parameters. For example, just like monitor natural attenuation, the regulatory requirements to have multiple lines of evidence to support this claim. For this technology, the monitoring requirement can also be set for better evaluating the technology performance in the field. In summary, we want to close collaboration among the three parts to better understand and apply this technology. So I think that's all I have today. If I have more time, so I can take some questions.
Thank you, Jimin. If you have questions for Dr. Fan, you can go ahead and write them into your Q&A pod down on the right-hand corner of your screen. Actually, I think that to stay on schedule, Jimin, we will save your questions till the end. And so, folks, you can still go ahead and type in questions, but we will save those to the end of the presentation. And now, thank you, Jimin. We will move on to our next speaker. It is Dr. Edward Winner. He has been the Assistant Director of the Division of Waste Management in Kentucky since 2016. He started his employment with the Commonwealth of Kentucky in 1999 with the Risk Assessment Branch in the Division of Environmental Services. In 2007, he became the supervisor of the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Plant Section in the Hazardous Waste Branch. And in 2011, he became the manager of Kentucky's underground storage tank branch. Edward came to state government from the University of Louisville Lions Eye Research Center, where he had been a postdoctoral fellow. He has a BA from Tennessee Temple University and a BS and PhD from the University of Louisville. He also pursued additional studies at the University of Louisville in Brandeis School of Law. Ed lives in Louisville with his wife, Jungju Lee, who's an employee of the Presbyterian Church USA. Ed, I'm going to hand it over to you. You may begin your presentation.
Okay, thank you. Let's move on to the next slide, which I will do. Here we go. Okay, sorry about that. Most of what I'm going to talk about today is our experience here in Kentucky. It may not apply to everyone who's listening, but it's the clearest way to be sure that the lessons that I'm presenting are accurate. So high pressure injection is something that we've applied to cope with low permeability geology, primarily clay soils. The emphasis that we've placed within our program is building solid conceptual site models, and it's important to understand your site before you apply a remedy if you hope to be successful. And in doing that, what we want to do is focus on the core contaminant mass. And at present, we've done well over 100 sites with carbon injection. The carbon that we've used for the most part has been the BOSS 200 product from Remedial Products Incorporated. So you saw that in Demin's presentation as one of the vendors. The first best practice is to understand what your goals are, what it is you're trying to accomplish. When you set forth to protect human health in the environment, say, for example, what are your cleanup numbers, what's being required in your state, when do you need to meet those numbers? That's something people oftentimes don't really want to deal with, but you should have for yourself a goal of when you hope to complete your projects. Where do you need to meet those values? Are we only talking about on-site or off-site or both? And be careful to not keep moving your goals. When you do that, it's hard to know actually when you're done. So that's the first best practice. The second best practice I've mentioned already is to locate the contaminant mass. The carbon and the contaminants of concern must come into contact. So as carbon is absorbed by contact and does not readily disperse, at least granular certainly doesn't, and carbon, powdered carbon disperses very little, it's important to inject the carbon where it will contact to the highest concentration contaminant. In most geologies, it is the soil media that contains the majority of the COCs. Characterization of the extent of contamination by groundwater may not be particularly helpful. Now, again, there's some variations in geology, but I'm going to stick with our lessons here in Kentucky, which are primarily heavy clay soils, not completely, but primarily. So here's an example of the importance in mass. If you look at the diagram, the brown represents 82% of the mass, which is attached to the soil media. 14% is in the groundwater, and 4% is in a vapor phase. Now, while that's not going to be guaranteed across geologies, that the amount attached to the mass is going to be the highest percentage will stay fairly consistent. So in order to be successful, you've got to avoid chasing water. What you've got to keep your mind focused on is where is the mass that I'm going to treat, so that if I'm going to use carbon as an amendment, that I'm going to get the carbon and the mass together. Best practice three, field characterization tools. You should use high density tools. Each COPC has its own character in regard to movement in the subsurface, but you want to find that core mass or masses as fast as you can, using tools such as UVOST, Field Lab, MIPS to determine where the parameter is of your release. These are all important in building a strong CMS. Understanding that core mass and its relationship to the geological media is superior to knowing the COC's concentration. This is something that often throws people off. They're worried about, do I have defensible data for court? You know, once you have a few pieces of data through the lab that prove that there is a problem, you shouldn't continue to try to prove that there's a problem. You should start concentrating on understanding the mass and that relationship, far more important than absolute concentrations. These same tools, such as UVOST, will ultimately save you time and money if you can act appropriately and prudently in a reasonable amount of time. Now, this diagram is really just to show you kind of a fancy picture of what, say, a UVOST characterization would look like. I don't know that it necessarily helps you a lot. So the first three best practices: identify your goals and objectives, even if you have to go to the point of writing them down so that you remember what they are. Collect high density and high efficiency data. Locate the core mass or masses. Avoid chasing water. Best practice four, focus on the carbon emplacement. Ensure that carbon is emplaced. Emplacement is both focused vertically and horizontally on the core mass. Carbon will favor the paths of low resistance. So if you have a low resistance pathway in the soil, you pressurize that, that's where the carbon's most likely going to go. It is important that you understand the character of the subsurface so that you can target features. Stratigraphy is important. How the soil and rock media are structured, which is just a definition of stratigraphy. You don't want to realize you've got a little bit of a problem, you've identified a mass, and yet you don't really understand the subsurface and move forward. Okay, so here's an example. If you look at, and let me pick up my arrow, which is around here somewhere. Nope, I don't see a pointer. Let's see if this, aha, there it is, thank you. Let me grab that. Ah, here we go. Okay, so if you look at the core, which I'm illustrating with the arrow right now, you'll see that this is pretty heavy clay, and you can see some carbon right here, and then you'll see the carbon has kind of fallen into this sand seam. So you're not really going to be successful with your injection unless you've characterized your site well enough to know that you have a sand seam such as this one, because the petroleum, in our case we're usually talking about petroleum, is going to favor movement through these kinds of features. This is another example of something you might want to do to appropriately characterize your site and understand what's going on. If you look at this resistivity diagram, you get in various pictures of what might be happening in your site, and it's happening within a relatively narrow elevation height, that you've got some perhaps fill material, some rock residuum, you've got silts and clays, you may have possible karstic features as well as competent rock. If you don't know the locations of each of these things and you're not taking them into consideration when you're doing your injection, again, you're unlikely to be successful. This next diagram is just meant to illustrate that at some point you may find that you have a site where the soils appear to be relatively clean, but your monitoring wells are remaining hot. So perhaps at that point you have a bedrock problem and you may have to characterize that. Again, your carbon will do you no good unless the carbon comes in contact with your contaminant of interest. So horizontal characterization, the extent of contamination sufficient for you to inform your remedy. You could always know more, and you should try to know as much as you can, but focus on the mass. Same message, don't pursue the water. As far as best practice number five, remove free product. it's easy for me to say that most of the mass is in soil. Of course, that's not necessarily true if you have free product. You kind of don't know at that point. It's kind of hard to quantify how much you actually have. So the best practice would be to remove as much free product prior to carbon injection as economically feasible. Carbon can absorb free product, but there are practical and physical limits to the amount of carbon that can be injected, and there are cost considerations. Excessive free product itself may also interfere with degradation mechanisms. So remove it if you can. Now, as I mentioned earlier, our experience is primarily with carbon, in this case, carbon slurries. And as pulled from the EPA Cluin line, high pressure emplacement is used for carbon slurries. The deformation of the subsurface to promote carbon delivery is through the creation of fractions. Pressure needs to be sufficient to overcome the stress, but you don't really need a lot of pressure. You shouldn't think of it as blowing up the subsurface, so to speak. You just need enough pressure to get the carbon moving. Now, your pressure ranges are going to be between 100 and 400 psi to keep carbon moving into preferential pathways. Daylighting does occur. We've seen daylighting, especially on facilities with a lot of infrastructure, as high as 20%. Otherwise, it can be much lower, 3 to 5% as a rule. Soil conditions are important. Infrastructure is important. There is always going to be a minimal injection depth depending on the consistency of the soil. So a general rule of thumb is you don't really want to start your injections unless you're about 3 foot below the surface. People break the rule fairly regularly, but it gives you something to go by. Now, the diagram that you're looking at, and I'm running the arrow around right now, is from Slack and Murdoch. And what this is illustrating is when your injectant goes into the ground and comes out the port, it has a tendency to want to climb. And you need to keep this in mind. And why it does this is pretty simple, that if you look at the mass of the earth that's on top of what you're injecting, the more weight you have, the harder it is for the injectate to move. So as the injectate moves up, you actually are dealing with less mass on top of it. So you'll tend to get these kind of upward movements. If you start your injection and just persist for quite a long period of time, you will see this kind of diagram. That's not normally how it's practiced in the field now, at least not for what we're doing as UST sites. There are some other things, other applications that we're not going to talk about where you might pursue it in this manner. So I think this is helpful. It goes towards understanding that your goal is not to, in a sense, blow up the subsurface, but to just emplace carbon. And I want you to notice several things about this diagram. One is the time, which I'm marking here. This is not a long period of time. And your max pressure, which I've written for you to see, would be 870 psi. And your sustained pressure, which in this case is 340 psi. And a flow, 35 gallons per minute is what it goes up to. So if you use a positive displacement pump system with a bypass valve to maintain a relatively constant pressure, what you're going to see is when the injection starts, the pressure builds, you have some sort of relief from your media in all likelihood, and you have a growing and then a sustained constant flow of carbon. So what you'll see is the rate of flow is actually independent of pressure. Hence, you're not exploding the subsurface. You're just simply getting a pathway going and then holding that for a relatively short period of time, 3 seconds, 4 seconds, 4 seconds, etc. Now, when you set up your injection, you want to alternate your injection points. I have it here as what's called a hexagonal orientation, but you would see your next point over here, almost triangles, at every 5 feet. also, as you look at the injection in the vertical, which is here, you'll try to overlap those vertical injection points. So you're alternating here, you're overlapping here. Again, you're trying to install a treatment field. Now, we've pretty much consistently used emplacements every 5 feet. If you look at the thesis by Christensen, you'll see she's arguing that it should be somewhere between 3 and 6 feet. Arcadis has some guidance which says between 5 and 7.5. So you can see that we're all very consistent with one another and how close these injection points need to be. The other aspect is that you're going to be adding mass to the subsurface. And when you add mass, you have to displace mass. That's, you just can't avoid it, right? So what you want to try to do is circle the area you hope to inject and work from the outside in towards the center. And this is a core best practice. The next important best practice is top down. And I know this is controversial. We have people listening right now who are going, oh, no, 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 no. But top down is a best practice. It's the one that we use. When you go top down, you're actually trying to, when you open up that soil and try to move carbon, you're doing smaller lifts with less mass on top of what you're trying to inject into. So you'll have a lower chance of opening large natural features while lifting that formation. You'll decrease the merger of lower injection points with upper ones. Remember me saying and showing you in the previous diagram how the carbon will want to curve upward? Well, you can let those things curve upward kind of like an upside-down Christmas tree, which you wouldn't be able to do from bottom up. You also have a lower chance of having short circuit back up the rod, so the rod has a tighter area as it moves down. You can get people who will argue that you will start bottom up, and the primary argument usually actually tends to be an argument of why you should do top down, and that is they'll say, well, if you start at the bottom, then you can actually increase the reach, and as the carbon curves upward, it can intersect the contaminant. And that is true, but it really is only true if your first injection point is all the way at the bottom. In other words, the bottom is the top. Now, a survey conducted by Arcadis recorded that about 70% of the respondents typically inject bottom-up. The presenter, Ryan Osterich, also said he didn't think that this was a best practice. It's not one we use. So best practices for injection of carbon slurries, 5-foot spacings on a hexagonal grid, initial injection about 3 foot below ground surface, install from the outside perimeter inward, inject from the top down, alternating injection depths to support the injection overlap, inject over 1 to 2 foot intervals. Use an injection tip which directs injections horizontally, and use a positive displacement pump. Now, this is just kind of a cautionary photo. This is what happens when you try to use low-pressure injection into clay soils. This doesn't happen to be a carbon product. It wouldn't show up as well for the picture. But essentially, it works poorly. Sorry about the quality of the picture. Now, once carbon is in place, what should be your expectations? Well, the first is that you will form new pathways, that if a low resistance pathway is not found, as you positively displace and push carbon into the formation, you will have to open something up. And that open area, you think of it as like its own sand seam to some extent, allows contaminants that are above the carbon injection point to flow to the carbon injection. So if you imagine this green as being an area of carbon injection, since this is now a lower resistance flow area, then contaminants that were not directly hit by the carbon can flow towards that higher transmissivity area. The other thing that you will see is the filling of existing pathways, such as old infrastructure, plants, roots, hollows, clay features, etc. Now, the next point is important to keep in mind. You are injecting below your feet. You can't see what's happening. You're forming some pathways. You're filling other existing pathways. But there are also going to be areas for reasons, you know, that you may not know, that they are going to be avoided. The carbon won't hit that area. So, you know, don't be surprised. It happens. Look at these fine soil features. This is not carbon, by the way, but it helps us understand. If this were a carbon injection, this might be your main fracking kind of feature, and then you would have bleed off into some of the smaller low resistance features here in the soils. And this is consistent with the kind of picture we're seeing, that you have the induced fracture and then you have these pre-existing areas that are filled. Now, this is a particular site which I'll show you some cores from, though all the cores I'm showing you are not from this site. On this particular site, we had 407 injection points on 5-foot centers. We put in 40,800 pounds of carbon across a 13-foot interval, which is kind of wide for us. Typically, we're more towards 9 foot, but it's within the range, and it was injected every 2 feet. What we saw from that injection, that we looked at 40 core logs, and of those 40 core logs, from 6 to 8 feet, we saw 56 of the 2-foot intervals had carbon. 53 of the 2-foot intervals had carbon in them. From 8 to 10, you had 65, 53, there we go, 53, 36, and 65. So generally, 20% of the cores didn't show carbon. 80% of the cores did show carbon, which, you know, in my mind is pretty good, but nonetheless. Okay, a bit more about fracture emplacement. The pressure injection carbons fill existing pathways, such as old infrastructure, plant root hollows, clay fractures, etc., when they're intersected. So in this picture, you can see an area here that was some sort of feature that was filled. You can see a little side feature here. This looks like an old root hole that was filled. And these kinds of features, if you look closely, are common. Now I want to show you this picture because, I don't know, you don't oftentimes get a picture this great of the subsurface. And this was where I was doing some excavation work myself, unrelated to my job here. And we were actually excavating under a house. These are nice clay soils. And I can assure you that these soils had not been touched or moved for over 65 years because the house was built in 49. And what you see here is a root hole. And the black around it is just the old degraded root. And, oh, that's a roly-poly bug. I don't know if you guys call them roly-poly bugs, but it does at least give you some scale. And here are some more root features. You'll see root features over here. You'll see them here. Actually, if you look careful, you'll see it here and here and over here, all these root features. And this is, I don't know what you would call this. Maybe some of you could tell me, but this is where the clay is kind of flaking and breaking loose as it's drying. And here's another fracture. So it's rare that you get such a clear vision of the subsurface that is, you know, cores are pretty small, right? They're hard to see. And this has now set like this for about 2 years, and still today, you can walk under, it looks the same. So imagine if you filled those, if you brought an injection rod in here and injected, you would see filling of these features. Now here's a core. And it's not unusual to, when you look at the sleeve on the core, it's as if right here or on the sleeve, it's as if you don't really see any carbon. In fact, here's the only little feature we saw when you cut it with the knife, and then all of a sudden the interior is filled with carbon, and you can see some carbon over here on this frag. Here is another feature right here that is attracted carbon, and you got carbon through here and here, again showing pretty good distribution in this core. Another core, this one's under UV light, and the carbon is showing blue, very well mixed in this particular case. You don't always see it that way. It depends on the character of the media, the soil you're injecting into. More carbon in this soil bore. This one is not from, a couple of these are not from the site I showed you earlier, but it's from other sites. This one's really quite nice. You see the carbon at very regular intervals. It's almost close to what one would think of as ideal. You get some lower resistance area here that's attracted a lot more carbon. Now, when you cut open the sleeves and look at them, they'll oftentimes have this bowed appearance. I surmise that that bowed appearance has more to do with how the clay slips along the side of the sleeve than anything else. But if you look at some injections of other materials that are done for industrial purposes, you will see that there is a kind of curving that tends to happen. So it's somewhere between what happens against the side of the sleeve and some natural tendency in injected materials. So once you've followed those recommendations, I would say this. How do you determine whether you've been successful or not? I think one important point to make with carbon is don't judge the remedy's effectiveness or by a standard that is far more stringent than you judge other remedies that you are presently using. So what you're trying to do with a carbon injection, and you can see all of these numbered injection points, is you're trying to build an injection field, a treatment field, if you will. And if you want to understand whether you've been successful in this field, it doesn't really help you very much to go back in and set, say, a monitoring well right next to the worst monitoring well you had before. May be clean, may not be, I don't know. But what you really tried to do was build a larger treatment field. So if you were to put monitoring wells back in, it may make just as much sense to put them in randomly, the same way you found the contamination in the first place. It may make even more sense to compare your media, your soil, before and after. Or, depending on what you're looking in, maybe you want to put in up and down gradient wells. I'll leave that up to you guys, but it is important that you realize that what you're installing is a treatment field, and it's the overall before and after mass of contamination that is your primary interest, not one point. So don't hold carbon to a higher standard of proof relative to other remedies and technologies. Rather, collect data sufficient to demonstrate you've met your remedial goals, collect data appropriate to your conceptual site model and reasonable expectations, that is, the most extensive investigation will fail to identify all sources of contamination. And as a side note, it's not unusual that when you're injecting in as close on 5-foot centers as we've suggested, for you to see free product that you've never seen before on a site. Maybe the site never demonstrated free product, but you've also never examined a site that closely. So the final COC mass in the field is the appropriate measure of success. Use high resolution tools. You can use these after, right? If you used them to characterize and build your CMS, you can always come back later when you think you're done and reuse the same tools. The installation of new monitoring wells, I've talked about that. You know, perhaps a random installation makes as much sense as anything if you want to characterize the outcome in a treatment field or up and down gradient wells. The last is just a list of potential guidances, which I hope you might find useful. I think Katerina is next. Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. I have seen a few questions coming in, but In the interest of time right now, I'll make sure that Dr. McKenzie has time to get through her presentation. We will hold these questions until the end for the last few minutes. Thanks again, Ed. Our last speaker of this webinar is going to be Dr. Katrine McKenzie. She's a senior scientist at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research, or USV, which is in Leipzig, Germany. This is a large government-funded institute that's dedicated to multidisciplinary research on the terrestrial environment. Katrine holds a PhD in chemistry and leads the working group called Environmental Catalysis and Reductive Methods in the Department of Environmental Engineering, and this is engaged mostly in water treatment and material design for particle-based in-situ groundwater treatment. Dr. McKenzie, please go ahead with your presentation.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. Do you hear me?
Yes, we do. Thank you.
Good. So you just heard about the utilization of activated carbon for in-situ groundwater treatment, and in my talk, I want to introduce you to a composite material, which Demin nicely introduced already, carbion, which combines the properties of activated carbon with the reagent iron. And that means we add chemical degradation, so in our case, the dehalogenation to it. We are a particle developer, and in my talk, I will try to link research considerations with results from field tests. I will guide you from decision making regarding the particle type to lessons learned from field trials. You will also get an impression of the particle design process. The starting point was that we, as chemists, were unsatisfied with the efficiency of the chemical reaction in highly diluted aqueous solutions, such as contaminated groundwater, which I tried to sketch here. And instead, a chemist likes to have its contamination in a flask, so that you have better control about the chemical reaction. And that means we, instead of a flask, use absorber pores, such as those of activated carbon, when we couple sorption and reaction. But what do we gain from that? I have to take this arrow away here. So let's take two perspectives. From the sorbent's perspective, the combination of adsorption and adsorbate destruction leads to adsorber regeneration and therefore prolongs the operation of the activated carbon. Please also bear in mind that often transformation products are less hydrophobic and therefore are less prone to sorption than the parent compound. And the second perspective I want to show is the perspective of the reagent ion. It makes a big difference whether the concentration of the contaminant is in the ppb or ppm range in the water bulk phase, or if it is many orders of magnitude higher in the sorbed state. Sorption increases the contact time with the reagent, the reaction is easier to control, we need less reagent since the ion is considerably shielded from other non-hydrophobic water constituents, and finally we also found that sorption of the contaminants in the vicinity of the ion can have a positive influence on the selectivity. So how can you decide for your field site if a sorption barrier is sufficient or if you should consider a sorption reaction barrier? First, let's assume you have an aquifer segment loaded with activated carbon particles. So the segment is, in my case here, 20 meters wide. That is about 60 feet, 5 meters deep, and 5 meters high, with the groundwater facing a cross-sectional area here of 20 times 5 meters. So the contaminant retardation coefficient R can be estimated with this equation. So what you need are parameters which you have anyway. So it's the bulk density of the sediment, the porosity, loading of the sediment with activated carbon particles, and the sorption coefficient KD of the adsorbent. So here we use a simplified approach of the constant Kd and the step function breakthrough. So the breakthrough can then be correlated with a barrier-specific term, so size and loading, a term describing the aquifer properties, and last, Kd is a term describing the adsorption properties. So with the adsorbent mass injected per cross-sectional area, you can estimate the sorption barrier lifetime. So let's visualize this for an example. Using our aquifer sediment and an average loading of the aquifer with activated carbon of 0.1 weight percent in total, that means 875 kilograms in the aquifer section, let's assume a groundwater flow of 0.5 meters per day. Then we have a contaminant. Let's take perchloroethylene here. And a typical contaminant, concentration in three ranges, 1 ppm, 10 ppm, and 100 ppm. For each concentration, we need a typical sorption coefficient, which we have to take from the sorption isotherm. For the lowest concentration of 1 ppm here, we expect a barrier lifetime of 10 years, which is quite a bit. And for this 100 ppm PCE, which is a typical concentration directly downstream of the source, for instance, breakthrough occurs already in half a year. So that means with such an information, you can decide whether a pure sorption barrier is sufficient to reach your long-term remediation goal or whether you should consider adding a degradation approach. For reduction of halogenated hydrocarbons, of course, zero-valent iron is a good choice, and in most cases, it works very well. Here, a variety of approaches were conducted where the nano-ion particle surface properties were altered with the aim of adjusting particle transport, reactivity, and source affinity. In ion-containing composites, carbon materials are often used as the second component. And this is what we did also. In our own developments, we went this direction, and you heard this already in Demin's talk. Carboiron is a colloidal composite, a type consisting of activated carbon in the size range of about 1 micrometer, with up to 30% zero-valent iron built into the particle. With carboiron, we have already field experiments, we also developed other particles. A new carboiron version is corrosion suppressed, and for oxidation we can offer other particles, including injectable fentanyl-like catalysts, we call them trapox, which can operate at a pH of 7, and a new catalyst type currently being developed for in situ persulfate activation. These materials are not based on carbon and are therefore outside of the scope of today's talk. So, but why would we want to combine zero-valent iron with activated carbon? Where is the benefit, really? Metallic iron has a huge potential as environmental reagent, and nano-iron is highly reactive towards halogenated substances and form more or less injectable suspensions. Since pure iron strongly tends to agglomerate, we originally thought that the activated carbon would be excellent as a spacer between the single ion structures. So in this electron microscopy image, you can see that most of the iron, these are the black dots here, are located within the carboiron particles and thus are shielded to a certain extent from groundwater constituents and from magnetic effects of the other ion particles. So the carbon matrix was also found to facilitate the transport of reactive species, such as electrons and hydrogen species, easily and not to bury the contaminant deep in the pores. So that means reactivity is maintained in the composite. In the end, there is a synergy of both material properties. The activated carbon brings the desired surface properties, such as negative charge, hydrophobicity, sorption affinity, and enrichment of the contaminants, and the iron brings the reactivity. So in combination, we have particles with a high subsurface mobility, which we don't know from pure iron, and the subsurface mobility lies somewhere between that of the pure materials. So a lot of them, what Ed told us about the mobility, applies here as well, but we have to use an additive here. We use carboxymethyl cellulose to provide a better mobility. So when it comes to field performance, the requirements and possibilities for fine-tuning depend, of course, on the treatment goal. So in order to build efficient and well-permeable reaction zones here, we have to bring enough particles into the ground without blockage, creating a wide enough zone for a sufficiently long residence time of the contaminated groundwater. So a large particle-loaded groundwater segment, to recall the term I used earlier, is then wanted. In this case, the particles should travel at least several meters. But what about the source? Here, you want to place the particles as close as possible to the residual organic phase. So does it now mean for us that we need two different carbo-ions? I would say yes and no. We need different behavior, but want to accomplish that with the same type of particles. Left, we want placement of high stoichiometric ion amounts near a source, and right, high distribution in a broad zone. Left, we want particles close to the source, that means targeted injection in a confined zone and immediate immobilization. Right, we want immobilization much later and at a greater distance from the injection port. So in column and cuvette experiments, we tested various scenarios in the laboratory. Travel distances can be predicted from mobility and breakthrough tests. And as I said, we use carboxymethyl cellulose, CMC, as a suspension stabilizer, which is environmentally friendly and available in food standard grade. Please bear in mind that the quality of the CMC, its molar mass and substitution degree strongly influences the solubility, and you want fully soluble CMC. So for carbo-ion, we were able to form stable suspensions in the presence of CMC, but by reducing the CMC concentration, we can also create metastable suspensions, which quickly lose stability when diluted. So column studies are essential, in our opinion, for prediction of particle behavior in the field. You can calculate from the breakthrough behavior, mean travel distances. For instance, this LT67 here means that the length of, this is the length that one-third of the particle mass passes, so two-thirds were immobilized on this transport length. So, and in order to control the transport distance and loading pattern, suspension stabilizers such as CMC really come into play here. So when we can easily provide full transport of carbo-ion of several meters when we add CMC in such a way that we reach optimal suspension stability. That means in that case we obtain sediment loadings which are rather low over a longer distance, but relatively even. And if we go down with the CMC concentration, we can have a higher loading close to the injection port, and can place the particles by immediate immobilization. As long as permeability is given, you can even conduct multiple injections on top of already immobilized particles. So for us, that means we have a stabilizer addition that allows us to choose either a plume mode or a source mode, which gives us much more freedom in planning our injections. We were fortunate to receive German and European third-party funding to conduct field studies with carbo-ion at several fields in Germany and in Hungary. Our project partner was the Golda Associates, and the site I want to talk about today is located in the northern half of Germany. A contamination there of perchloroethylene was found in a near-surface aquifer, and the hotspot PCE concentration exceeded 125 milligrams per liter. The aquifer was mainly sandy, so this is quite a difference to what Ed told us, and we had a porosity of 15 to 30%, and a moderate KF value reaching a mean groundwater distance velocity of roughly 20 centimeters per day. So typically for a chlorohydrocarbon spill, the aquifer was rather anaerobic. So the site was a former military area where the current problem owner are the local authorities, which made things much easier. And you see here the contamination area was roughly 100 meters times 100 meters, and you can see it is overbuilt. It is an overbuilt area with some of the buildings still in use. With this figure, I want to give you an impression of the investigation status of the site. And even though the PCE spill is more than 50 years old, no remaining solvent phase was found. The plume is relatively confined because there is a seasonal change in flow direction. So almost no transformation products are present, no vinyl chloride at all, no traces of the, or only traces of DCE, and minor transformation to trichloroethylene. This might be due to frequent changes in redox conditions because it is a shallow aquifer and we have precipitation events which have an impact on the redox conditions here. Since carbo-ion was to be injected for the first time, we wanted to start with a smaller amount to in order to learn. So what is the optimal concentration, how much suspension stabilizer is really necessary, and is the handling optimal? And for this, we started with a single injection as a port, just one port, here the red area with, marked with one. And later on, we had a larger injection in blue, marked with the two here. And this first injection was just 20 kilograms, the second one, 120 kilograms. But nevertheless, the first injection of this 20 kilograms gave quite conclusive results to us. So zooming in a bit more, you see on the left the single injection with the initially affected area in gray and the closest sampling port in green, blue, and red. And please remember this sampling port GWM1 here because I will talk about this later on. The arrow here shows the groundwater flow direction. So the 20 kilogram sample of carbo-ion was suspended in 2 cubic meters of water, which means a concentration of 10 grams per liter, and the CMC was added at a concentration of 2 grams per liter. So one additional cubic meter of water was used to subsequent rinsing. Well, in summary, a sediment volume of about 20 cubic meter was filled with carbo-ion suspension, forming a bulb of more than 2 meters in diameter. I will come to the larger injection right later. So just some impressions. Here, the fire brigade adds the water from a hydrant. Here you see the dry carbo-ion is added and thoroughly dispersed. Here you see the nitrogen rinsed carbo-ion suspension in black. And here you see the suspension, which was excluded from air and slowly injected into a depth of 6 meters via an infiltration lens. So we applied just a little bit of pressure. So monitoring at the groundwater downstream from the carbo-ion injection at the GWM1 port directly 4 to 5 meters downstream from the injection port showed a contaminant decline quite quickly and a rebound after the first 10 weeks. Well, the rebound is not surprising when we recall the small amount of carbo-ion applied here, only 20 kilograms. But nevertheless, the PCE concentration here is much lower than the initial concentrations. So at this point, you may say, well, carbo-ion consists partially of activated carbon. Maybe the PCE decreases, a decrease is just sorption. So as shown before, I use my retardation factor. And I calculate here, with all the parameters I have for the site, a retardation factor of 38, which means that the PCE travels 30 times lower through the carbo-unloaded zone than the water does. And if it's just sorption, no products would be found. But we find products. Hydrogen came from iron corrosion, and when perchloroethylene is reduced stepwise by iron, we expect trichloroethylene, all the dichloroethylenes, vinyl chloride, and the three dechlorinated C2 hydrocarbons. And this behavior is known also from NZVI. Well, but carbo-ion shows a different behavior. We observe that the direct pathway to the gases here, to the C2 hydrocarbons, dominates. No additional TCE is formed, no vinyl chloride at all, and also acetylene was not found. DCEs were present in traces. So that means when we find ethylene and ethane right away after injection, then this for us is a marker of for the abiotic dechlorination reaction. So at the sampling port GWM1, we saw earlier that the PCE concentration went down and we have the rebound. So, and for the ethane and ethylene, we see appearance right after injection, and later on we see that they even become the main constituents in the groundwater. So we have high concentrations, and we interpret this as being a result of PCE enrichment at the particles before degradation and a chromatographic effect through the barrier. So the reduction equivalent of the 20 kilograms of carbo-ion, well, is used up quite quickly, we thought. And in the hotspot area, we calculated that the carbo-ion would survive like 2 to 3 months. But surprisingly, we see that ethane and ethylene production still goes on much further here. So for dichloroethylene, we saw that right after injection, traces appear, then they disappear again, and then they reappear. But the reappearance is a bit different because we now have a changed selectivity pattern. We have more cis DCE compared to the other DCEs. So especially that was for us a sign that there might have been microbial activity at the site. So we looked a bit deeper into this issue and analyzed the microbial communities after 3.5 months and found, instead of the expected typical dehalogenating species, Dehalococcoides, others, which are not so often discussed, Polaromonas species. And they do a nice job. That means they don't produce the carcinogenic vinyl chloride as the Dehalococcoides do under anaerobic conditions. Polaromonas are not strictly anaerobic. And this measures with the fluctuation of the redox conditions in the shallow aquifer at our site after the rainfall events. So several indications lead us to the conclusion that, at the site we experienced a cooperation of the chemical reduction and microbial degradation processes. You see here that our activated carbon was also the settling medium for the microbes, as you saw before. So let's come to our second injection. Here we conducted 15 months later the injection of 120 kilograms of carbo-ion injected into 18 points, and we did the same as Ed told you. We first placed a ring around the hotspot area and then injected into the center. This is quite different from a classical barrier, but we then hoped that the smearing by the groundwater flow of the carbo-ion bulbs here would affect a larger area. But what we learned here, that directly after the injection, the analytical data showed a chaotic picture. So since the water packages were shifted back and forth, so in different directions by the injections, And for the overall picture of the site, the groundwater needs to pass through the whole zone so that we reach a steady state. This is what I would just give you as a message here. So let's have another look at the monitoring point GWM1, because this is located right in the center here and is affected only by the center injections. After the drop we saw after the first injection, we again have a sudden drop after the second injection. So we have here a drop from 19 ppm to levels far below 5 ppm, ppb. So that means at the same time, we saw also the ethene and ethylene, as we saw here, popping up right after injection and in a high concentration. So that means we did not only measure sorption or replacement of the water with clean infiltration fluid, this is definitely degradation. So the original contamination with a hotspot area of 125 ppm here in the middle of this in dark brown of about 40 times 10 meter where no microbial activity was found was then changed to a contaminant profile after 2 years where we have a marked decline of contamination in the area, a sustained decline, and it is also worth mentioning that the project's aim here was no full remediation at the site, but we learned a lot about the carbyne behavior. And for full treatment, we would need more material, of course, and the site owner now plans a full remediation using our iron-activated carbon composite. So before I come to a quick summary of the lessons learned, I wish to add that the material has been thoroughly examined for its ecotoxicological behavior by several of our project partners. Using various test standard systems, from algae to fish embryos, with standard tests and newly adopted test systems for particles, it was found that the carbyne does not show acute toxicity, and this was very encouraging also for further application. So, well, what are the final messages I want to give you? We learned at our site that carbyne showed a very good performance within the observation period of more than 2 years. We could show that the contaminant concentration went down markedly on the long term. We learned how to optimize the infiltration parameters and that a microbial participation can be utilized in an integrated approach with abiotic treatment. So the combination of sorptive enrichment and chemical degradation was of benefit. Well, and then I only can thank all of listeners for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. McKenzie. We are running short on time for Q&A, but I just want to squeeze in one here. Someone asked, what was the maximum depth of previously successful application of the activated carbon injection? Ed, can you maybe answer that question? What's the maximum depth that you've seen successfully? And if not, maybe Damin has seen some more of those.
Yeah, I can take a shot at it. 35, 40 feet, I think, is what we've tried. I don't know how much deeper we've tried. I don't really, to be honest with you, I don't know why depth itself would make a difference. It would be more the interval length that would be a bigger problem in the sense that if your interval were long enough, it's hard to fill it, right? But yeah, that's the best answer I got.
Okay. And was that a highly heterogeneous substrate you had there, or?
Well, yeah, I probably overplayed to some degree in my presentation the clay aspect, simply because I didn't want to appear to be, you know, rooting beyond that which I had information, if you understand. But you know, when it really comes down to it, the soils in Kentucky are high in clay, but they're heterogeneous. There are soil seams, you know, there are sand seams and various other features, as you saw in some of the cores.
Great. Thank you, Ed. And thank you again, Dr. McKenzie and Dr. Winner and Dr. Fan, for all of your presentations today. I'm afraid that we're out of time for questions, but if you do have more questions for the speakers, you will be able to contact them. Let me just go through some closing items real quick just to wrap things up. Again, thanks to our speakers. Thanks to everyone who joined us today. I know we had a number of international participants as well as those here. I want to remind you, please stay connected with Kluin by signing up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, where you can learn about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. And thanks again for joining today's live webinar. I want to remind you that the slides and other items related to today's session can be found on the on this webinar seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation today. You'll also find information for the speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as we noted earlier. I want to ask that you take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session, both the content covered and the method of delivery. This feedback form is required if you would like to obtain a seminar participation certificate. We don't issue PDHs or CEUs for our webinars through Kluin, but you may save or print a webinar participation certificate after submitting feedback for today's event. Be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify you were here for the entire event or that you have replayed the complete archive. If you do not check the box, then you will not receive a certificate. And you may find that a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email are enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution for PDHs or CEUs. If you participated as a group today, each person can fill out that feedback form to get their own certificate, and this applies to those watching the recorded version as well. We do look at your comments, and we try to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms that we use here. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. If you require any further assistance, please feel free to contact Jean Ballant at ballant.jean@epa.gov. And lastly, I want to remind you that today's session was recorded. In the near future, you'll be able to access these slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. That will be in approximately 2 weeks. You will receive an automatic email once that archive is available. And that is the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining on today's session. I hope you found it to be a valuable expenditure of your time, and we will